In the summer of 1998, Michael Rosen and his wife, Leslie, brought their sons to play in Tompkins Square Park. As residents of the East Village, Rosen and Leslie Gruss, that's her last name, had a bird's eye view of the park from their penthouse apartment, and they routinely took their children, Ripton and Morgan, to play on the jungle gym. One particular day, Ripton wanted to do something else. He wanted to play a game of pickup baseball. That decision led to a permanent restructuring of the Rosen family. Michael Rosen writes about this experience in the new book, What Else But Home, to be published by Public Affairs. I'm pleased it brings Mr. Rosen to the show. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you.
Describe that first pickup game.
We walked onto a baseball field where we were the only white people. It was a typical summer game, sandlot game, except played on blacktop.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys let Ripton play.
And Ripton is how old at this point?
He was seven, almost eight.
And most of the boys in the game are a little older.
The boys, there were a few boys his age, and then boys raged up to the late teens.
Mm-hmm. And had he been in a pickup game before? He was
no,
obsessed with baseball.
He was obsessed by baseball like a lot of little kids are, but that was his very first time in a game.
What kind of kid was Ripton?
Ripton didn't see color. He had no idea of who the kids were, other than they were boys with bats and balls and gloves, and he wanted to be one of them.
In terms of making his own friends and other friends his age, Ripton had some trouble, right?
Well, I wouldn't say trouble. Ripton's a very focused person, and he left for college today.
Oh,
so
really?
He's not.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're talking about the 8-year-old Ripton now.
Yes. Ripton focused on one kid at a time, so playing with a whole group of people was different,
mm-hmm.
Except after the baseball game, he said, "Who wants to come over?" And 10 or a dozen kids did.
Well, what I was trying to establish is that it's important to know through the story that Ripton does have some problems integrating a lot of sensory input. He has a sensor. What is the official
word
for it?
Well, Ripton, when he was young, he was diagnosed as having sensory integration issues. And that's something that kids really do grow out of, and he has. But at that point in his life, that's what he was defined as.
And Ripton and his younger brother, Morgan, and how old's Morgan at this point in the
Morgan
story?
Was 2.5 years younger.
Okay. And you adopted them both. They're in your house. You're living in an East Village that's very different from the East Village of today. I mean,
very different.
Any playmates that they might have had would have had to come from school where they went to a school uptown.
Our kids were going to a white Jewish school on the Upper West Side at that point.
And I think at this point that you say that there were very few, you know, sometimes you'd have kids from his school over the house, but very rarely was the invitation extended back.
That is true.
So at this point, some of the kids, Ripton invites them home with him.
Correct.
What do you think?
He invites both sides of the baseball field home.
He invites everyone who's playing home.
And this was 98. We didn't know that these were kids from public housing, and kids did not have Nintendo generally then, so they came for Nintendo. And my wife Leslie and I were really thinking, my God, like the neighborhood is really coming to us, which we wanted. We moved to the Lower East Side because we wanted an integrated, diversified neighborhood, but we hadn't found it coming into our house.
The first group of kids, how many kids were there in that first group?
10 or a dozen kids came home.
So it's a crazy time, and they stay late.
They stay late. Right. They eat us out of house and home, literally.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Right. And so you think, what an experience, what an exhausting experience. Okay, we'll do whatever we do tomorrow.
Right.
Only the next time he plays baseball,
The next day, Ripton brought us back to the park because he loved playing baseball. Which I know you can appreciate because I understand that you are a coach.
I have coached, and I, you know, used to work with kids, and I'm doing a big series on high school football. So I'm very steeped in the power of sports to create friendships. And it seems really important for Ripton, especially because everyone calls him Ripken. Cal Ripken
was still widely known then, and even though Ripton was, in right field or on first base, he was Ripton. Ripken.
He was Ripken. And, of course, Ripken, I shouldn't say of course, but you named him after a town in Vermont?
We named him after the town in Vermont that Robert Frost lived and wrote in. And actually, the title of my book comes from a Robert Frost poem as well.
And Robert Frost also wrote about baseball.
Robert Frost wrote something quite stunningly beautiful about an All-Star game he went to watch.
When does – so one occasion, a bunch of kids come back. Next occasion, a bunch of kids come back to your home. When does it become something other than visits from a big group of kids? When does it start to present itself like this might be either more permanent or a more profound experience than just a play date with some friends
right.
who are a little different from Ripken?
Right. Well, pretty soon kids started sleeping over, and it was summer. So they'd sleep over a night, go home. Then when school started, the five boys who we really became parents to started sleeping over every weekend. And then my wife's rule was that they had to go home on a school night. And June came, July, somewhere around July, we realized that they hadn't gone home since school let out.
Mm.
And that happened again the next summer. And then later in the story, later in our lives with the boys, we realized that one of them, Carlos, had stopped going to school.
Right.
And he was going to fail.
I want to back up for a second. The five boys, why don't you name them all, give us a sketch. But did they establish themselves as more or less permanent fixtures in your home because they were Ripton's best friends of the group or because you saw something in them that they needed you?
They saw something. They were the ones who kept coming. They were friends with each other.
Yeah.
And they're 4 or 5 years older. We called them the bigger boys. We still call them the bigger boys, even though they're now young adults. And Leslie at one point instituted a half-hour reading rule. Yeah, every day that kids were over, they had to read. We all had to read for half an hour. And those are the boys who survived the half-hour reading rule.
Okay. So does that mean – and it doesn't mean that they were good readers. It means that they had to put up with something they didn't like very much, reading, and it shows that they
Correct.
Really wanted to be there.
Correct. They were not net – Juan Carlos is a reader, but Juan was the only natural reader.
Yeah. And in fact, you would say, circle every word on a page you don't understand, and you'd look at their books afterwards, and some of them circled a lot of words.
A lot of words. And yeah. We had read that if you circle more than like 3 words on a page, you know, it's beyond your reading level. And these were books already below their reading levels. Now, I say that today their reading levels are wonderful.
So they come to your home. They make themselves more or less permanent fixtures. What's going on with Ripken at school and what's going on in your marriage? How does their presence affect that? Maybe it mucks things up. Maybe it is the one, you know, ballast, one port in a storm for what's all the tumult that's
well,
going on.
Well, there's tumult is a good word because there was a lot of it. Ripken and Morgan eventually stopped going to the school on the Upper West Side. That really happened when Leslie and I separated. I understand that the night that I moved out of the house, the bigger boys went down to Tompkins Square Park and sat on a bench and said, you know, like, my God, did we cause this? But that's what kids do.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't cause it. I'm not an easy person, and I had decided that it was time for our marriage to end. And in fact, I lived out of the house for 2.5 years.
They didn't cause it.
Did
the fact that there was so much chaos? I mean, you've looked back. Was it good chaos? Was it more stressful?
Oh, I think it was is wonderfully deconstructed chaos. The kids would throw themselves off of a knee wall balcony that we had playing world wrestling, you know, WWF. They would play a game throughout the entire house that they called the gun game. It was like a tag,
yeah.
Except they'd turn off all the lights in the apartment and put flashlights on the end of the guns and tell us we couldn't open the refrigerator. So I think we were crazy.
Yeah.
But I think good crazy, and I think it has saved 5 lives.
Tell me, I want to go back. Name the kids and tell me a little bit about each one.
Okay, so our boys, Ripken and Morgan. Carlos is a boy that figures very prominently in the book. He is Puerto Rican descent, and he had just showed up in the Lower East Side about a half a year earlier than we met him. When his family popped out of the homeless shelter system, his father was murdered in front of his eyes, which put them into the shelter system. Phil or Felipe was born in the Lower East Side and attended school there. He lives in what's called Lower East Side People's Mutual Housing, mm-hmm. And he's Dominican. William was born in the Dominican and grew up in the Lower East Side when I think he was six or so. Kindu lived south of Houston Street. He's African American. And Kindu is our only African American son. And his family, we learned years later, said, you know, why don't you go live with those white people? Long before that ever happened.
And his older brothers were drug dealers.
His older brothers have all worked on the street. And there's a good number of them. And Juan, I haven't mentioned. Juan is his father is African American. Juan was never brought up by his father, and his mother is Puerto Rican.
So we're speaking with Michael Rosen, author of What Else But Home, Seven Boys, meaning his two adopted sons and five of his pretty much adopted sons.
Fostered sons.
Fostered sons, Seven Boys, and An American Journey Between the Projects and the Penthouse. So at this time, these kids are becoming de facto foster sons, and eventually, you know, some of it becomes formalized. Almost, as reading the book, almost everyone that you have an interaction with who works with the family sees this and says something's wrong. They object. Your nanny, a guy named Johnny, says they're using you. Their tutor, the kid's Hebrew school tutor, says they're using you. A woman you were dating after you separated says they're using you. Why did you stick to it? What convinced you that those people and it seems like everyone you talked to were all wrong?
They were kids. And of course they were coming for the Nintendo and you know, the fact that we had a refrigerator full of food, because at the end of the month, their families didn't have food in the refrigerator. You know, at the end of a month in a typical family that lives that lives on support, by the end of the month, the milk is gone. And by the end of the month, the milk was still in our house. And so of course they were in quotes using us in that way. But Ripton adored them, and it was clear to us that they adored Ripton as well. And there's a purity in that childhood, in that child love.
You are really forgiving, I think more forgiving than almost anyone I know. I'll give you a couple examples. Two of these boys you recommended for a job in the building, and they just skipped out on it. And
they did.
Yeah. And then at one point, and this was maybe the
But I explained to them what they were doing wrong afterwards.
Right. And they said they understood.
But that's raising children, isn't it?
Right. So this is the thing that struck me. There is one really troubling incident. Well, to me as a parent, it would have been when Morgan was a very young boy. One of the boys, and it's not one of them who wound up being your foster son, took his shirt off and took Morgan's shirt off, and they lay on top of each other. Now, at that point, I think 90 to 95 out of 100 parents would have said, that's it. This experiment is over. But you said, let's not make too big a deal out of it. Let's address it. Let's separate them. How do you handle that incident?
And let's not let those kids go somewhere alone where we don't see them.
Right.
And I think a lot of parents do that sort of stuff. You know, there was a time when stuff started disappearing from our house. And you know, sneakers would start to go because kids would collect sneakers and they wouldn't come back, and shirts and things like that. And then iPods came out and an iPod or two went missing. There was a moment when money went missing. And then it went missing again from my wife's wallet. And we had an idea of who was doing it, but we figured that by the time he was 35, he probably wouldn't be doing it. Mm-hmm. So our job was to get them from then to 35.
Mm. And so did the fact that these – oh, I have to ask one thing. What interaction did you have with with the kids' parents?
With their moms. In the beginning, we thought that it was parents. We learned that, you know, very typically there's moms. They'll have brothers and sisters who are fathered from the same man or other men. Our relationships have been different with each mother. Some of the moms I haven't met yet. Leslie's met almost every one of them. These are boys, which I also think is typical. By the time a lot of kids, boys, are 7, 8, 9 years old, they're out on the streets. And so they're not asking their moms.
The Book starts with an update on where they are. Unusual but effective, because there's no tension in like, oh, did any of them really not work out? A couple of them joined the military. A few of them are in school.
Now, starting in a couple weeks, every one of them is going to be in college, except for Morgan, who's still in high school.
Who's still in high school.
Which is a miracle.
And when did you say, have you said yet, you know what, this thing, we could now call it a success?
Oh, to me, it's an astounding success. No one's become a brain surgeon or...
they're 22. I mean,
right,
come on.
Right. Or I was going to say an NPR radio announcer. But but every one of them is alive. No one's hurt anyone else. None of them have been hurt. No one's in jail. And everyone's in college. So to us, this is a miracle.
Have they read the book?
Two have. Ripton said he's never going to read it because he doesn't want to get angry at me. And he's turned into an enormous boy, so that's okay with me for now. And they certainly talk with each other about it.
Has your wife, Leslie, read the book?
Oh, my, yes. Leslie read it two times before it was published, one for the sake of our marriage and the other, I think, for enjoyment.
You got back together?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Leslie and I got together. I don't want to give away everything in the book, but we did get back together.
And were you diarying at the time? There's so much detail in there, like what everyone ate in every meal.
Well, I was trained as an anthropologist. I was a professor once upon a time. So this is a memoir without me as the protagonist. And it's yes, I diaried and I took notes.
All right. Michael Rosen, author of What Else But Home. And we should mention that Michael Rosen will be giving a talk and signing books on Thursday the 17th at 8 o'clock at the National Arts Club, 15 Gramercy Park, Gramercy Park South. Thanks very much for being here, Mr. Rosen.
Thank you.